Thank you for joining us today for the first episode of the Whitaker Report, a discussion with thought leaders about the future of economic development. My name is Dean Whitaker, President of Whitaker Associates, a data analytic company serving the needs of economic development and commercial real estate organizations. I will be your guide as we endeavor to see around the corner. Today we will be speaking with Joe Raso, President and CEO of Greater Fargo-Moorhead Economic Development Corporation. Joe has spent more than 27 years as President and CEO of six development organizations. He has experience in downtown, rural, metropolitan economic development, including focuses on workforce development, existing industry services, business attraction, and innovation and entrepreneurship. Joe is a frequent speaker on the topic of economic development, specifically in the areas of workforce, innovation and entrepreneurship, business retention and expansion. He is also an instructor for the Kentucky Institute of Economic Development's annual Base Economic Development course. Please join me as we welcome Joe Raso to the Whitaker Report.
Hi, Dean. How are you?
I'm very well, Joe. Thank you for taking your time today to join us. I appreciate it. Appreciate your willingness to kind of share some of your thoughts about where is economic development headed? And one of the things that we wanted to discuss today was kind of what you see going on with workforce development, and I think particularly what are some of the trends you see and what direction are things headed?
Sure. Well, I look forward to having the conversation today and sharing a little bit of my background and thinking around the topic of workforce development.
You'd mentioned the 1099 workforce issue when we were had this conversation a little earlier. What is that? What is the 1099 workforce, and how big is it?
Well, you know, it gets defined in a number of ways. We call it the gig economy or the freelance economy. I tend to refer to it as the 1099 because that's the IRS form that about a third, believe it or not, a third of the U.S. workforce will receive a 1099. That's growing. I think right now the numbers are around 157 million people in the workforce. Let's say pre-COVID, okay? About 57 million. 58 million of those receive those IRS 1099 forms each year. So in some ways, they're independent contractors or freelancers doing work to make a living.
Why would the sector be growing? What's some of the drivers behind that trend?
Well, when I think about this, and this takes us back quite a ways, back in the 1950s, a gentleman by the name of Ronald Coase won a Nobel Prize in economics, theorizing what was the importance of a company, a corporation, a firm. And his theory was that it was to lower transaction costs. It was to allow for trust to be built between employees within a firm so that they could work efficiently and effectively delivering their products and services and had trust across the various people who worked in that type of setting. And I think, you go forward now over the last 70 years and you see how technology has advanced to really allow people to have trust in others who may not be within that firm because they can see through technology. Upworks, for example. You can go out there on their website and you can find people with certain skills. You can get see their ratings by others, and you can kind of build trust in knowing that, hey, they're going to be able to provide this service for me, for my business, whether I'm a large corporation or I'm a small business myself. So I really believe that as technology has advanced, it's allowed us to gain confidence that individuals out there across the country, around the world, can provide a service to me. I also think that, this isn't just a one-sided thing. This isn't just individuals who decide, hey, I want to go off on my own and work and do, provide my skills to a variety of different people. I also think it's a strategy that corporations are doing more and more, as much to stay competitive, but also, there's the factors of legacy costs, right? Your healthcare costs and others, that if they're not borne out by that firm, and they can just contract for those services. They can kind of, you know, control their overall financial environment a lot better.
Do you think this 1099 approach reduces the company's risk in terms of the risk that they take in terms of having employees versus having contractors?
Well, I think it can. I think one of the challenges is, and there's probably being dealt with more and more in the HR community, is what is an employee, right? You know, there are definitely federal standards defining an employee. In fact, you know, we're doing this interview the day after the national elections, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that California just voted that Uber and Lyft workers are contract employees and not employees of Uber and Lyft. So, you know, these kind of workforce dynamics we're seeing in play more and more. And I think, yeah, the companies themselves, I've been doing this, as you said on the intro, 20 some years, and I still don't recall ever sitting down with a CEO who he or she said, hey, I'm looking to hire a bunch of people. I want to. Really, what they're looking to do is get work done. And it just so happens that traditionally you hire people onto your firm. But if you can obviously get that done in another way, and it's less costly to you and less risky long-term in terms of overall financial costs, then they're probably going to choose to do that more often than not.
What impact do you think COVID has had on this issue of 1099 versus employee and future workforce issues?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, COVID more than anything has kind of accelerated some of the things that we've been seeing happening out in the world, whether it's logistics and supply chains, automation, that's going to be playing more of a role. And, you know, we've seen it on the horizon, but I think that horizon's coming up a lot faster for us. And maybe it might be too early to tell too, right? How COVID's going to affect the 1099 worker. But, you know, one thing it's definitely done is it's put more people into home, right? Working from home. And so there's a dynamic shift there in terms of how work is getting done. And we'll have to see, you know, how that plays out as hopefully we come out of the pandemic here in the next 6, 12, 18 months or whatever it takes to see how that changes how companies work with their relationship with W-2 employees, let alone the 1099. But I can tell you from being here in the Fargo-Moorhead region and seeing companies like Microsoft, which have a very large operation here, pretty much saying to all their employees, I think Google's doing it, Amazon, a lot of the tech companies are saying to their current workforce, you work from anywhere, right? Just we need the work to get done. But if you want to live in Fargo or you want to live in Tulsa, as long as the work gets done, we're happy.
What do you think that means for economic development, that work from anywhere idea?
Well, you know, Upwork just came out with a survey this past week, and they estimate anywhere from 13 to 23 million people will be moving because of their ability to move and still do work for their company as a W-2 employee, or maybe, you know, them thinking from the standpoint of this freelance gig 1099 employee standpoint. You know, even if that doesn't occur at that level, you know, maybe it's half that. Well, you know, or it's a quarter of it. You know, at the very least, maybe it's 3, 4, 5 million people. Economic development has been so traditional about how it measures its success, right? It measures it from projects, jobs that those projects are doing, capital investment that those companies are doing in investing in technology or more, you know, square footage. And I really think that we're missing the boat in economic development if we can't find a way to measure the growth of what I call the ones, right? You know, it's the individuals who say, hey, I'm going to stay in my market, but I'm going to be working for these companies located all over the country, all over the world. We don't count that, right? But every dollar that person makes from providing their products or services to others and they stay in your marketplace, they spend that locally. And that money churns in the economy. I mean, that's the whole point of, I think, economic development. And we're not counting it. And nationally, I think the Bureau of Labor Statistics and one other federal agency, they've been talking for years about sharing at more of a metro or county level what that freelance economy looks like. And until we do that and we start to measure it, you know, we do what we measure, right? We're incentivized by what gets measured. And if we're not going to measure that part, then are we not missing out on the opportunity of helping a part of our economy that's already 25, 30, 35%? Seems crazy that we wouldn't figure out a way to do that.
What would be some possible ways that we could measure it?
Well, I think there's federal data on currently what the size of that workforce is in the different metros. Then, you know, looking at what's the programming that a community could undertake. You know, could it develop or identify a physical area within the community that it provides the type of benefits that a freelancer, gig economy worker would want and would need. You know, mobile space, high broadband, kind of understanding of set costs around things like childcare and healthcare, right? Because again, you think about a firm, you work for a company, what do many companies provide? They provide healthcare. So now you're an independent contractor and you're bidding out a project. And if you're a one or two and your healthcare costs go through the roof or they change on you, you know, that contract you just bid on may not be profitable to you. So there's, you know, there's, I think, a lot of things that we could be doing in economic development and having a more meaningful conversation around this topic. And there are people in the field who I think say, hey, this has always been here. It's not important to focus on it. Many of these 1099 workers are local workers, meaning they're plumbers, they're electricians, they're real estate people. And that's true. That's very true. But when you go and look at 57 million people, not all 57 million of those people are kind of local contract workers. And I just personally believe there's a missed opportunity for us in economic development to talk more about it.
I understand. What would you say is the average income of a gig worker in terms of what are we looking at in terms of economic impact?
Yeah, I don't have that in front of me, Dean, to share. But if people go to freelance and Upwork, I think it's upwork.org or upwork.com, they team up with other employment type organizations to look at those factors. Mm-hmm. The last one I saw was probably 3 or 4 years ago. And I just can't recall. But my gut tells me that they're at or above, you know, what the kind of the going wage rate is in your local market.
$80,000 a year was the number that came out in some earlier reading about that I did a few years ago. I did a TEDx talk on the future of work. And my colleague in that had done some research, and he said the average gig worker was $80,000. And so what we were looking at is, you know, so if you look at a company, you attract 100 employee organization, you have to provide a lot of, you may have to be providing incentive and infrastructure and a bunch of other things. But it strikes me that gig workers don't require a whole lot of incentives or other things, although there's some communities, as you know, that are offering cash incentives or assistance in subsidized housing and some other issues like Tulsa. And I think Vermont just offered $10,000 if you move to Vermont and your work is outside of the state, meaning that you bring money back into the state for the work that you do.
Right. Well, and how different is that than the strategy that economic development's been engaged in for 2,000 years, but
a little time.
Or more, but at least since the 1950s, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we pay to attract investment and jobs at a larger level. This is just what Vermont's doing. Is just doing it at the level of one.
Yes.
Right.
So, exactly.
You know, and so when people push back on those kind of programs, I think we shouldn't be so quick to judge and maybe step back and say, well, why is that being done?
Yeah, well, and, if you look at Facebook and some others, they're suggesting that you can work from anywhere. And if you mm-hmm. do so, the one thing they were looking at, though, is adjusting wages depending on
yeah.
local economy.
Market.
Yeah. But I think the ones who make out like a bandit are those that work from a lower cost location, but yet provide their services in a different economy. And so mm-hmm. if you look at the people we employ in like New York, and you're selling into a New York economy, and yet you're living in Holland, Michigan, you're arbitraging, I think, the benefit of working in a lower cost yeah. environment.
So why, you know, begs to ask the question of why aren't markets that are, I'll use Fargo-Moorhead here as an example, you know, 250,000 people, stable economy, strong housing markets, you know, just kind of overall strong economic variables to it. And markets like this, I think, have the opportunity to be places where individuals who say, hey, you know, I don't want the hour commute both ways. Mm-hmm. I don't want the some of the challenges we've seen in the past several months with social unrest. I want great schools for my kids. All these things that we talk about and tout to companies. Well, what are we doing to entice individuals, especially when these companies in the tech industry definitely are saying, hey, work from where you want to work. Some of that may be pulled back, and there's already people pushing, saying, it's like co-working. Hey, open space, that's not working for people. Mm-hmm. I tend to see these in kind of macro 5, 10, 20-year chunks. And the trend's still going up for those types of things. They might not be, it might not be a hockey stick kind of growth, or it might go up and then come down. And the minute it comes down a little bit, people say, see, I told you so. I told you that way of work wasn't going to last. But it's really the trend over time. And I just can't believe personally that, that we're not going to see a different workforce, a different way in which work is being done, a different set of variables for how we serve companies with our space, right? Just what's going to happen with commercial space here in the next year or two is going to be really interesting to follow. I know our topic here is 1099 freelance, gig workers, but it all kind of mixes
it's
in.
It's all connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
What I've noticed recently, we've been hired to help market an office building that's vacant because the work from home workforce is working for this company, and they decided they don't really need this 400,000 square feet of office space anymore. And yeah. so they're not going to renew their lease. And I'm hearing that over and over again in a lot of areas. However, a flip side of that is Microsoft, Google, and Amazon have all gone into New York City and are leasing up large floor plates, which is almost like counterintuitive. But at the same time, they're looking past the pandemic and saying, at some point down the road, 2 years from now, we're going to have this property, and it's a dime on a dollar right now. So let's mm-hmm. go in and lease up some of the space that's now available because the current tenants aren't renewing their leases. So I see both sides. Talking to some yeah. folks in Louisville yesterday, they were just dismayed about the out-migration of their core city from a work point of view, and having those workers working from home, and how that impacts their downtown area, not just the office space itself where those folks were
yeah.
housed, but all the businesses that those people were supporting in the downtown area. So I'm concerned for our city. Do you see anything like that in your area too?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should be concerned. I personally am not overly concerned. I don't go with the notion that cities are dead or they're going to mm-hmm. die because of this pandemic. I think, like most things in life, you kind of assess the lay of the land and you make informed kind of decisions. I think you just mentioned some of the big tech companies looking to buy up lots of real estate or lease lots of real estate in the big cities, you know, that's probably a good financial investment play for them at this point in time. And, you know, here in this market, you know, we're really concerned about what the next 6-8 months is going to look like as it relates to hospitality, retail, and restaurants. And hopefully continue to strengthen and grow the primary sector base, because without that, as we all know, you know, no one's there to shop at the retail or go to the restaurant when things come back to more of a normal environment. But I think, you know, cities have to be flexible. I think those conversations need to be happening now of how can we utilize this space here for maybe purposes that we weren't even intending or thinking we would do, because of the fact that we may lose 25 to 30% of our commercial space to businesses, you know, or maybe instead of having companies that have entire floors, maybe it ends up being, you know, subleased, and you've got now 5 or 6 companies in that space. The one thing I know is that when you get people together who have different backgrounds and different experiences, and they're allowed to commingle and share what they're working on and doing, a lot of pretty cool stuff gets created. New businesses come out of it, you know, being more competitive within your own industry. So again, how are economic development groups positioning themselves to help with those kind of exchange of ideas, kind of like Stephen Johnson talked about over a decade ago, you know, where good ideas come from. And I think we have to be mindful of making sure that that kind of entrepreneurial ecosystem is strong and allows for those interactions to take place, which again is going to help existing firms. It's going to help the startup. It's going to help the contract worker, you know, be competitive. And those are the things that, that we focus on, things that keep me up at night. It's, you know, it's not the basic blocking and tackling as we're seeing these changes. You got to do that, but it's thinking about, you know, topics like we're talking about today.
What do you see the impact of both robotics and artificial intelligence having on this whole issue of how work gets done?
I think it's shining a light and speeding up at least people's discussions around it and how it might apply to their industry, even if they weren't thinking about it. And think of, well, that's, you know, that's the autonomous car industry, or that's, you know, another sector. A good example for us here is, we've had a local organization called Emerging Prairie that we helped to stand up more than a decade ago, focused on this entrepreneurial ecosystem. And one of the things that they've been working on for a few years now is what's called the Grand Farm. And that is a plot of land in the southern part of our region where companies, it could be data companies like a Microsoft, it could be, you know, global companies in ag, CHS or OPC or Cargill or whoever it might be, looking at how we're going to farm in the future and what is the role of autonomous systems to doing that work. So essentially what's being created here is the autonomous farm. Everything from, you know, from planting to applying fertilizer to, you know, herbicides to insecticides to harvesting, getting the product to market, and all the varieties of things that are done, where you literally have, you know, robotics on the ground and you know, UAS in the air. And you know, how they interplay with one another, how data is exchanged, you know, very quickly, and what kind of systems do you need to actually make that work? So, you know, there's an example of one sector that's a pretty darn important sector to our entire planet, and how you know, AI is going to play into that. So, for those markets that aren't finding what I call where their niche is, and then figuring out how to apply more of this non-human capital work to it, you know, they may be well on their way to being irrelevant. And that's where I think things are continuing to go is, are you relevant on a global scale? Are you a naturally nested region that has kind of almost like city states that are connected to other naturally nested regions? And obviously, you know, we're just rolling out of a major election year where we talk about states and the federal government, but it still seems to me like the economics of the world are playing out by these regions and their research and their industries and their exchange of ideas and people and technology.
So you see work getting done in a more automated way when it comes to agriculture, is what I've heard you say.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And are there others in your part of the world that are doing other industry sectors doing the same?
Well, the energy sector here is looking at the same thing. Now, for those listeners who don't understand North Dakota, the eastern half where I am right on the Minnesota border is not in what they call the oil patch or the Bakken oil system. That's on the western half of the state. But that's playing in, you know, to how energy is, you know, research and how autonomous systems are being applied in that area. We have a pretty strong finance community. Even in like accounting, for example, I mean, we have one of the 20 largest privately held accounting firms, iDaily, headquartered here. And they talk about, you know, how they're structuring their business because with technology, all of the kind of basic work that's being done for audits and for tax returns and things of that nature, you know, most of that is starting to be automated. And if that's happening, then they look at their workforce, which has kind of been a pyramid. You've got all these young CPAs that come in, they get experience, they're doing all this tax work and working with the partner with these companies. And then you know, the firm says, wow, these three people who have been doing the kind of the basic grunt work, they really work well with our clients. Let's now move them up to a project manager position, right? And get them into more of a management part of the firm. Well, what happens when automation and technology takes over that ground level, that entry level work? These firms are trying to figure out how do we get people on board to do our work when a lot of the value added is in the experience, right? A number of their partners over the years became CEOs of very large firms. Border States, which is headquartered here, $3 billion business that serves the utility industry around the country. Their former CEO was an accountant and was a manager at iBailey before going to Border States. And so it just is interesting when you have these conversations across just about any industry sector to hear from these leaders on how technology is changing the way they have to think about not only kind of their basic service to their client or their product, but how it affects their entire workforce model for them. And those are, those are not, quick solution discussions. And I think for communities that set themselves up to be a kind of a team member, so to speak, and understanding what issues they're facing and trying to help them in any way that we can, I think, bodes well for those kinds of markets that are doing that work.
What are some of the things that your economic development organization does to partner with them to help them do the things they mm-hmm. need to do?
Yeah, well, a number of things, and some might surprise you. On the workforce front, for example, we do a lot of implementation of technology that we have access to, systems that anybody could utilize, companies like MC or Chimera or others that are very well known in the economic development world, using their systems and technology to give our companies more specific and detailed strategic information about people they might want to recruit, and help them identify markets, help them identify, you know, people with experience, not just people coming out of you know, undergrad at our institutions. We also know that in our market, you know, when I say Fargo, most people think cold. It's actually 72 degrees today on November 4th, which is weird. But anyway, but they, you know, they think the movie, right? Or they think, wow, it's out in the middle of nowhere. They don't think it's a quarter of a million people. They don't think, wow, you just invested $600 million in your downtown in the last 5-6 years. You know, it just, it's just not known in the way that it actually is. And so we try to help our companies as they're recruiting people to give that experience to that person. And sometimes you have to do that digitally, right? You can't do it because they're not here. They're not on the ground yet to check it out. But we even help our companies, Dean, help them identify people in other markets that they may need in that other market. A good example, we have a company in the benefits service industry that was looking for some sales agents in Denver. And we said, well, we can help you identify people there that you might want to reach out to. And it, you know, they go, well, why would you do that? I said, well, if you hire a salesperson in Denver to help you get business, what does it mean on the back end here? And then, you know, to, it connects for them. Well, yeah, we'd probably have to hire a few more people. And I'm like, yeah, exactly. And we want your business to be successful and you're headquartered here. And in those cases, though, too, they may not even be hiring somebody to work in their facility. They're hiring somebody who's going to work out of their home who just needs good broadband. And that person could be 50 miles from here, 200 miles from here, or whatever. So, you know, again, it's you've got to have your leadership understand kind of how the economics is working and kind of give you permission to do this kind of do it in this way, which, as we all know, is not a traditional way of doing economic development.
Yeah, that speaks well of your leadership, that they understand the trends and the importance of what the work that you're doing, even though it's not being done in a very traditional way. Good for you.
Right.
Well, this has been a very interesting conversation. I want to be respectful of your time and understand what you have on your plate to do today besides have this conversation. Just a little bit of an aside. My grandson now is going to go to school in North Dakota. He's registered for Dakota College, and he's a left-handed baseball player, first baseman, okay, pitcher, and outfielder, and the college recruited him to come there to go to school. It's a two-year school, and when he arrived there for just a couple of weeks ago just to check out the school and the opportunity, the whole community knew his name. Little town, 1,850 people or so, but the whole community was involved in recruiting students for the college. And so it was very interesting to see North Dakota and some of the connectiveness of it. The coach, the baseball coach there, came back there after leaving the community to go to college because he felt so loved in that community. So you have something special in North Dakota, and I think we'll see how all this turns out. He's from Oregon, so he's going to be experiencing winter in a whole new way.
A whole different way, yeah. Well, there's really about 1.5 degrees of separation here, I've learned, and I've been here for 2 years, and I was at an event even before my family moved here, and my partner Bree grew up in this area and was talking to somebody at this event. It was a TEDx event, like 3,000 people, probably the largest TEDx event in the country is held here. And in that conversation, and this is how crazy it was, he starts to tell me how he had dinner one night at my partner Bree's grandparents' house in Hannaford, North Dakota, population probably, you know, 100, 200 or whatever. And, you know, I'm just going, this is crazy. So, you know, the old adage of, you know, don't burn bridges and hopefully leave a good impression with everybody really applies here, because everybody is connected, you know, in at least 2 degrees of separation, I would say.
Correct. Well, thank you very much, Joe, for your time today. And Really appreciate your thoughts and willingness to share those with our audience.
Thank you, Dean.
Wish you well in your adventure. Thank you for listening to the episode of the Whitaker Report, Seeing Around Corners, and special thanks to Joe Raso for helping us better understand the changes taking place in the economic development world.